Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, my name's Stuart Miles and welcome to the Pocketlint Podcast. This week, Pocketlint's Dan Grabo and I talk about the new LEGO Super Mario sets out on the 1st of August that brings an interactive Nintendo experience to the humble play sets. I talked to co-founder of AI voice technology company Synantec about creating a voice AI that can cry, and Cam Bunton joins me to give his verdict on the new OnePlus Nord smartphone. Is it good enough to stand out from the crowd? But first, back to you, Dan. Tell us more about LEGO Super Mario.
Well, it's been expected for quite some time. LEGO and Nintendo announced much earlier in the year they were going to team up over this. And basically, this is a playable selection of sets. There were 16 sets in the range. But the key element is the starter course, which is a beginner set as such. And then onto that, you build various expansion packs and power packs as well. And basically, it all fits together, and you can pair the Mario character with the app, although you don't need the app while you're actually playing. And basically, you can explore the Mario world in that way. And Stu, you've been playing with it, haven't you? And
I was going to say, I'm going to fess up now that I've become a child again for a little bit of time, and have been building the sets and stuff. So we started with LEGO kindly sent us the starter set. They sent us another set to do with piranhas, where you've got like a slide that you've got to move. You've got to slide up and down collecting coins, but without hitting the piranhas, so you don't kill yourself. And then they sent us Bowser's Castle, which is the kind of the big daddy set there. It's a really interesting experience. I was really surprised, because on all the pictures that you can see on Pocketlint and elsewhere on the web, Mario just looks like this naff bit of Duplo. We've all kind of got beyond Duplo now when we're playing Lego. But when he actually turned up and I got him out of the box, he's battery operated. The eyes in his tummy are a color LCD display, and actually pretty good quality color LCD display, and he's got a little speaker in him, so he's going Mario time and things like this, and obviously interacts with the pieces that you're playing. So each the he has a color light sensor underneath him, so when you put him on certain bits of Lego or these little tiles that kind of got like a barcode, almost like a QR code I suppose, on them, he reacts in different ways. And so if you put him on a red bit of Lego, he thinks that's fire. And if you leave him there, he'll die. Which is quite good fun. I can see this. It feels like when I heard about it, I thought, oh, this is just a cash in, you know, Lego and Mario, two brilliant brands, you know, aimed very squarely at kids. Oh, this is just, you know, throwing some money at it. And it feels like it's actually someone's thought about it, which is quite novel.
Yeah, absolutely. And what does the app actually offer you? Because obviously, you know, you don't actually need it to play. So what does that offer? Is it sort of instructions?
Yeah, this was one of the only frustrations is you do need an app to all the building instructions come on the app.
Ah, right.
So they've got rid of all of those, you know, like some of as you know of building. I mean, what's the biggest set you've built? You've built like some of the Star Wars
Millennium Falcon, which is 7,000 pieces.
Yeah, and the manual, the building manual that comes with that, is kind of like a couple of hundred pages.
Yeah, at least, yeah.
Yeah, and so now they've taken that and just put it all into either an iPhone app or an Android app, or you can run it obviously on iPad as well. And so you click through the, instead of turning a page in a paper manual, you click through the instructions on an app. And that's useful in some ways, because you can then move the pieces around like you're in a mega CAD drawing, so you can see, if you can't see it perfectly on the side, the angle that they've shown it to originally, you can obviously just move your finger around and spin it around and look at it from a different angle and different direction.
Cool.
which is nice. And I think they've gone with this option, partly from a sustainability perspective, I would presume, but also because each instruction, once you've built the set, it then allows you to play a video which shows you the interaction of Mario and how you're supposed to play. And suddenly it's a very white sort of set that comes in, and there's a child's hand that sort of is holding Mario and he's bouncing around and doing all this stuff, so you can see what you're supposed to do. Like one of the pieces in I think it's in the starter set, is you build a cloud with a little stick to hold the cloud, and the video at the end of it shows you that you put Mario on the cloud and then you move him up and down as if he's on a cloud to get to the next bit of the game.
I guess that's a key difference, isn't it? Because you with a normal Lego set, you build it, whatever set it is, and then you play with it or have it on the shelf or whatever. But with this, because because all the sets work together, but you buy them separately, it's more of a system, isn't it? And it needs to adapt to what you've actually got.
Yeah, and I think my son who built it with me he's 12, and he was quite he thought it was a really good idea that he really loved the interactivity of the new manual rather than a paper thing, because he could see where it was difficult to build or what have you. But also he felt that it allowed him to see what was going on, or what, you know, the videos allowed us to work out where it was supposed to fit in the game and all those things. But he did like that ability to then the kind of suggestions of how you're supposed to make the track, you know, the course that you're building, but it's not definitive. And then at the end of that as well, there is this sense that it's not just that, this is not a piece of Lego that you sit on your shelf and do nothing with, because it's just a bit unwieldy to do that. It's not like a Millennium Falcon, or it's not a specific single item at the end. You've got a lot of bits, because they're all this part of this track and course and stuff. So I think it's an interesting approach from Lego, because it does give you that sense of building a game. It's almost like you've gone back, you know, these are level building processes from like decades ago, probably how they tried to work out how to build Mario in the first place. But it'd be interesting to see whether this flows through to other things through Lego. And this is a good example of where it'll start. And then you'll get other game style Lego sets that not are only in the Mario world, but in other worlds as well.
So can you just go and buy the starter course, and which is £50, $50 as well? Or can you just play with that, or do you need other things to get going?
You can. The starter set, I think it's like 50, 60 quid. You can get effectively you get the Mario, which is the bit you're paying for here, because as I say, he's got LCD, he's got speaker, he's got accelerometer, gyroscope, he's got the light sensor. Do you know what I mean? It is a fully fledged, it looks simple, but it's a fully fledged piece of electronics. And then there's not much of a course. There is a basic course. You've got those, you know, you've got a flag to jump through at the end. You've got a few, if you think you've got a Grumba to destroy. You will tire very quickly though, from that, because it's a starter set. So you then, in theory, you could make your own Lego, you know, your own tracks with your own pieces of Lego. The key is these little barcodes that fit onto the monsters that you're trying to destroy or beat. But ultimately, you could make your own course, because if you just by jumping Mario up and down, like shaking him up and down, the gyroscope knows that, and the accelerometer knows you've moved him, and so you can collect coins and things like that. So you can have fun. I think you would need to spend a little bit more though to get some of the expansion sets.
Yeah, so you're talking sort of about £100, $100 to start off with, aren't you? Because you've got the £50 starter course, and then the expansion set start at £25. So if you had a couple of those, and in fact they get quite expensive, don't they? Because the Bowser's Castle one is
£100. Yeah, £90, something along those lines. Yeah. So I think it's certainly for Lego, it's an interesting direction, and I think that it's, having played with it now, it doesn't feel like the Duplo clash-in that I thought it was to begin with. And you can see that not only will they probably, if it's a success, I suspect there'll be lots more Mario expansion sets to go on from that. But I could also see them easily doing licensing deals with other platform-esque games going forward. I don't know whether there is a restriction or whether they can do a deal with Sega for Sonic, you know, the other famous platform game there, or just other, you know, other notions within their own licensed IP of, you know, a Nexo, was it Ninjago and things like that. You could easily do something similar from that. It's a very different approach and a more playful approach to Lego as we know it, based on the fact that over the last 10 years, it does feel like Lego is now just really about building massive sets that sit on your shelf and not actually get played with. Still to come, Cam gives us his verdict on the OnePlus Nord smartphone.
For me, I think I would like to see them sticking to that the never settle attitude that they're always talking about and going, let's not follow the crowd.
When you think of computer-generated AI voices, you probably think of Alexa, Siri, or Google Assistant. They're better than they were, but they don't have any real feelings to them, do they? That could all change, though, thanks to Synantec, a company that is specialised in giving voice AI feelings. Here's an example of their work so far.
I can still hear voices. Sometimes, if I'm lucky, I hear her. And it's like she's right here with us. Her warmth, her love. I miss her. I just don't understand. What did I do?
Faith, there's something you need to know.
Mom, don't leave me. You can't just go.
You need to find out for yourself.
Waited long enough. I'm ready to know.
Now you know the truth.
Mom!
Is something wrong?
No. No. I'm just so, so happy.
All the voices you've just heard were computer generated. Impressive, isn't it? But how does it work? What are the implications for the tech? And where can you expect to see it being used in the future? I talked to Synantec co-founder Zina Qureshi and started by asking her to explain just how it all was possible.
We, on one side, we work with actors and we synthesize their voices and we create a profit share with them. So anytime their voice gets used, they get passive income. And on the other side, we have studios, entertainment studios that need voice acting on demand. They're looking for a performance. We alleviate the issues of casting, editing, directing, booking recording studios, the whole long voice pipeline that can be very painful. And we make this quicker and easier to use. And essentially, everything we do voice tech wise is around quality, having a very natural performance. So this is something very different to the average text to speech because we look at the subtleties. We're training our algorithms to have the nuances of breath, cadence, intonation patterns, emotions, projection levels, like all of these little things that people use to express themselves through voice, we're putting into our technology.
Now, voice assistance and voice acting isn't anything new. We obviously, when we all started using sat navigation systems in our cars, there was always that turn left, turn right, at the next junction, et cetera, et cetera. A lot of the time you hear stories in the past of that would be someone having to say every single word to make that a reality. And then the disjointedness of those words would then come out to be something quite silly. That then moved on from a technology point of view to Amazon Alexa, which is completely digital voice. There is no human involved. Does your technology take that to the next level, or is it a mixture of the two? Or just sort of from a process, how do you get the voice into the system, or is there no voice in the first place?
Yes, so we work with actors and we do recordings with them. We have a process and strict audition guidelines that we need them to work with. And then we use a set of recordings and then we model their voice. And this is pretty crucial because talent is key here. So if you look at personal assistants, it's usually around how quick can that personal assistant answer your question? Does it understand your question? Mm. Whereas what we're doing is focusing purely on a quality performance using text to speech, where the actor's talent matters. And so we're just creating a way of augmenting how actors already work. And so this creates a way to get quality voice acting fast. So if you need something to be spoken, say you're a content developer at a studio and you need this done as quickly as possible because you're iterating on a title, this would be able to take your workload from like months down to minutes.
Wow. And so what kind of examples, you know, where is this being used? Where do you see this being, like, where's the key usage for this?
So we're actually in a beta right now and we're seeing a few different use cases. Initially, and what we're seeing right now is a lot of studios are using this for pre-production. And then as they continue to hear out what their narrative team is working on and how it fits into level designs at studios, and then how the audio team finesses it, it really helps with the way their workflow goes in their pipeline, making really strong entertainment products. So some users like this for all of their voices within their story. Some use it for pre-production to test out material. Some use it for, I guess, pickup lines. So there's definitely a variety of use cases here, and it's still being explored.
And this is primarily in games rather than sort of animation or movies.
So we're seeing it. We started with gaming studios, so we have more information around gaming. But we're also seeing a similar use in animation and film and TV because the pipeline is very similar. And so, like, my co-founder, John, his background is he is a speech researcher, but unlike most speech researchers, he's worked on Hollywood films for over a decade. He was working on the post-production dialogue editing pipelines. And right. It works very, very similarly to the way it works in gaming.
And so the idea is, I suppose, from a gaming perspective, you can then have it where you can have multiple story branches and it's all being voiced by the AI rather than having to spend hours recording someone saying all those lines.
Yes. So with studios, like, they still have their actors that they like working with, but this can help augment how that works. Like right now, we also saw like a huge interest because with Corona, actors couldn't go into studios like they used to. So people were looking for non-traditional ways to try to fix the issue. And sometimes they need to iterate really quickly. So like with our technology, this definitely helps them to get further with their projects. And yes, with actors, like, some of their voices have been voiced already. Some of them need to maybe do a few more lines. And that's really difficult because ordinarily you would need to go through the full pipeline again of like having to book a recording studio just to get one more line of dialogue in. And this is something that maybe will alleviate that pressure for actors who might be signed on to other jobs at the time and studios who need to work quickly.
And so do you think there is a point where you could start using it for voice assistants, or do you feel that it's still very much scripted dialogue that you need to focus on?
So that's definitely a good question. I think voice assistants don't necessarily need that quality. If someone was looking for an assistant that sounded more like Jarvis and her, like the movies, that's definitely something that would make that relationship between humans and computers, probably like even more immersive. And that's pretty fun. Like, I know Alexa is making games, there's personal assistant games, and we're seeing this a lot through who we're working with. And so I think there's room for that, but that's definitely not a key focus for us at the moment.
And how does it cope with different languages? Is it just English, or can it do, if you had a Spanish actress or actor, could that suddenly work in that language, or French? Or
so, yes, we are in English only right now, but it isn't difficult to do a different language. And we actually started, like, when we first raised our seed funding, we actually had British accents. Now we have American accents, because a lot of people like Hollywood voices. That's more of like the popular demand, with the neutral American accent. But accents and languages, it's just a matter of, I guess, training on those models, working with actors that are native in that language, in that tongue, that sound quite natural, so that we ensure that we get all the nuance and subtleties from that language.
And would that mean you'd be able to get, could your AI speak another language, or is it that you have to have the original voice in that native language? So it's, I can't speak Spanish, for example, but if you recorded my voice, could the AI make me speak Spanish, or sound as if it's me speaking Spanish?
So that's definitely something we can do in the future, and it's in our roadmap. Like, we would be able to, yeah, I guess, create a Spanish version of yourself. Like, that's what you're asking.
Yeah, I suppose it's that sort of sense of, if it comes to dubbing a movie, could you take someone like George Clooney, for example, and say, right, now we're going to get him to speak Chinese, even though he can't speak Chinese, for the Chinese dubbed version. So at least when you're listening to a dubbed version, it sounds like George Clooney rather than someone that's been brought in to just record the voice of George Clooney.
Got it. Yeah, I mean, that's something that we're definitely going to be looking at, especially when we do languages, because people want the dubbing to be as natural as possible, or else it's not an immersive experience when you watch the film or the TV or whatever it is you're watching. Because, you know, we see entertainment as a form of happiness, as escape, as, you know, storytelling. And so the dubbing has to fit. And I know a lot of people already turn off TV when it doesn't sound good. So we'll be looking at matching that quality when we get to creating more languages.
Now, one of the things that perhaps raises an initial question is the ethical elements of this, and just that understanding of, you know, if you look at the internet at the moment, a lot of videos, there's a lot of chat about deepfakes, you know, the idea that it's implying that someone is, you know, overlaying, using special effects to overlay on other faces and things like that. If you add the element of a voiceover in addition to that, what do you feel are the ethical things that you have to be careful of or aware of as you build out this technology?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we take misuse very seriously. My background is I worked in social impact for 6 years. And so we don't ever train on voices that are unaware of their voice being synthesized. And I know a lot of companies might train off of YouTube, and there can be things that people try to explore there, but that's not something we're doing. We build a partnership with every actor so they know exactly where their voice is going to be. And this also prevents deep fakes, because you can't just take a voice and then recreate it. Like, we control creating the models ourselves, and the actors are aware. And then we also work with entertainment studios specifically, where the quality matters and they need voice acting on demand. So I think we're taking parameters to definitely look out for this and keep it as safe as possible. And then we also, in our tech, are preventing any hate speech or things that could be alarming to be generated.
And I suppose the final question I have is, if people are interested to hear examples of this, are there any sort of examples in games at the moment, or is it demos? And if so, where can they go and listen to more?
Yes, so right now we're in a private beta, so everything is under wraps. And we do have some demos on on YouTube. Like, we created the first AI that can cry, so people can go and have a listen to that. And you can see the behind the scenes and the interview with one of the actresses we have, as well as some of our teammates. And then we have samples on our website where you can hear different voices that we've created with the actors that we work with.
An AI that can cry. How's that even possible?
That's a good question. It's definitely possible. What we did is we looked at all the different nuances between being like slightly sad to very deep sadness, where it goes into a speech pattern that isn't even actually speech. It's more of like a guttural sound. And we wanted to prove this out because everything we're doing is around performance and nuance. And if you can't get those elements of depth, like, it's not going to sound natural. And so it's definitely possible. And this is something that John was explaining to me when we first started working together. Like, there were things that he saw in speech research that were great, but then coming from his film background, there's a lot of nuances and things that he would hear when he heard Christian Bale perform that didn't necessarily happen with speech, text to speech. So that's something that we're doing differently. And when he explained this, I actually understood what he meant, because I had to teach a lot of nuance to the children I taught. They were completely nonverbal, and I'd have to talk to them and express emotions to a level where they would understand it and be able to replicate it and repeat it to communicate with me and communicate with others. And so for us, like, we took sadness and crying, because that's one of the hardest things like an actor can do. Like, when we did auditions, like, a lot of people, when they audition, it's easier to get angry than it is to just, I guess, break down and cry. Right. And so when we found that, we said, we're going to prove this out, and then we can do it with all of the rest of the emotions. So that's exactly what we're doing.
And so I suppose then the final question leads me to, what's the next emotion?
Yeah, right now we're doing several emotions, actually. Happiness, sadness, anger, and fear, like different levels of those. We've had our algorithm sound sarcastic before. We can get the algorithm to whisper. It's pretty cool. It's definitely the funnest job I've ever had.
The OnePlus Nord is the latest phone from OnePlus. Just don't call it a comeback, though. That's the roughly paraphrased message the company has stuck to throughout the lead to the launch of the new OnePlus Nord smartphone. But can a new sub-£400 smartphone really be an alternative to the £1,000 flagship devices on a market that we all want and lust after? And just how has OnePlus been able to return to making more affordable phones without alienating its fans or cutting corners? Well, the good news is that Cam Bunton is here to tell us what he thinks of the new phone, having been reviewing it for the last 2 weeks. So, Cam, what do you like?
There's a lot to like. I think it's like you said, they have to cut corners. But I think with OnePlus, it's more about staying true to what people expect from their phones. So you still get this really fast and fluid and smooth experience. The software is uncluttered and is getting closer and closer to being more like the pure Android that a lot of the tech fans love. And it's got a battery that lasts easily all day and it charges quickly. So it has a lot of those key elements still.
And so does that mean, when you talk about going towards a more vanilla experience, does that mean that this is kind of a Pixel 4a, if ever we get it, a kind of a 3a device that would be a comparative mix to, or is it more to the Motos, or is it more to the Chinese brands?
It's an interesting one. It's something I noted in the review as sort of like a passing thought more than a critical analysis, but it feels a bit like when Google used to team up with other manufacturers to create the Nexus brand phones, because they were very pure, very stock, vanilla, as you say, Android experience, but it still has this power and fluidity, and it has that attractive price point. It's not anywhere near the £1,000 price that you would pay for a really highly polished premium or ultra premium phone.
And so what's your favorite bit about it? Like, if you would say this is one thing that you need to pick out, what would that be?
The one thing, and for me personally, it is that fluid and lightweight experience of when you're gliding through various elements of the software and switching between apps or playing games. Everything is just smooth and effortless, and it does it without stuttering or lag. It just feels like a very polished software and performance experience.
Now, you've talked to us about the nice things. What have they got wrong? What do you think they could have done better?
I mean, it's hard not to criticize the camera system again. It seems like a recurring theme with OnePlus.
Yeah.
Like
I'm sure you've said that before about OnePlus devices.
Definitely. Even on the flagship phones, you get to this point where you're like, it's so close to being good, but it's not quite there. And I think with this one, it's not alone in this in the mid-range market. They've put a four-camera system on the back, so it's got a quad-camera system. Except two of those sensors are really low resolution. One of them is for macro photos. One of them is just for extra depth information. There's an ultra-wide camera on there, but then that one isn't quite as good as the main camera. So really you end up with this camera system where you've got one camera that's actually a really good camera on its own. And most people will be very happy with the results in terms of sharpness and ease of use, color. And then you've got these other three that seem to be there for no real good reason.
No rhyme or reason.
Yeah, it feels like it's spec boasting. You see, they're not the only ones. Motorola have done it on their Moto G series. They've got a quad camera whereby only one camera is actually decent. So for me, I think I would like to see them sticking to that never settle attitude that they're always talking about and going, let's not follow the crowd. Let's actually just put two good cameras in the back and ignore the rest, because that would be a much better, more premium experience, and one that would make it a more attractive phone, I think, personally.
Now, overall then, do you think this is something that will, you know, is it something you should think about getting if you're in a market for a sub 400 phone, or do you think you should really just spend perhaps the extra couple of, maybe £100 or whatever, and get one of their more traditional phones that they would call flagship?
No, I think it's an interesting one, even though I've said obviously all that stuff about the camera as an entire package on its own, as a whole, it's still a very, very good device. And in the price range that it's in, which is under £400, you're going to struggle to get anything that's as complete as the OnePlus Nord. It's a full package. It's a really good phone. And actually comparing it to the OnePlus 8, there's only a few things that you don't get, like the premium sort of frosted glass finish on the back and the curved display on the front. But it gives you all the real basic stuff that you need, and it does it really well. So for the price range, it is a really good phone, and it's going to be one of the best ones around for the next year or so.
And do we think that's the thing? Do you think this is a standalone device, or is this now a new? It feels very much the way that they were marketing and stuff. This is a new range. This is a new thing where we're going to see a lot more Nord devices. Maybe the Nord 1, Nord 2, Nord 3, over the next couple of years. Do you think that will only grow better, or do you think it will suffer from the same problem or same scenario of OnePlus, which eventually it starts at £400 price bracket, but then it gets, you keep on adding stuff and it's suddenly £800 in a couple of years' time?
Yeah, it depends. I think it does depend on what the prices of the ultra premium in their range does. If the high-end phones start creeping up over £1,000, which would be really unusual for OnePlus, then I can imagine that these would get more expensive again as they add more stuff to it. But I think the key focus on the Nord is to try and keep that cost down and to give you as polished and as premium an experience as you can get for that kind of money. So I can't imagine that it's going to go up too much. But I mean, you just don't know, do you? Things tend to creep up all the time from all manufacturers. So we'll see. It's definitely the first of many, though. It's not a standalone device. It's going to carry on, I think.
Well, that's it for this week's show. Thanks for listening. Until next time. Pip, pip.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.